Most Wanted podcasts on BBC Sounds. Where is the missing crypto queen's billionaire scammer?
It starts to get very scary, very, very fast.
How did gangster's drug baron finally get caught?
He was taken completely unawares.
Why were Bern Wild's environmentalists labelled eco-terrorists?
For a long time, they were getting away with it, but that wouldn't last.
Uncover a new case
while the dog drags you out for a walk.
Listen to True Crime Podcasts on BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
It's a sunny Sunday afternoon in Hungary, and the drivers are lining up on the grid, psyching themselves up for the race ahead. McLaren driver Lewis Hamilton is ready for battle. In pole position, he knows his chances are good for a win. The vibe is rather different for teammate Fernando Alonso, way down in sixth position. Sure, he's grappling with the fact he lost pole position to Hamilton after yesterday's pit stop fiasco, but he's got his mind on something even bigger. It's been an emotional morning. Only a few hours ago, he was threatening his boss, Ron Dennis, telling him to jeopardize Hamilton's race by letting him run out of fuel. Or else, he'd spill the beans to the FIA about an email chain that showed McLaren insiders did know about that Ferrari data after all. It was an ill-advised outburst, but with the race about to start, there was no time to go back and apologize in person. So?
Alonso sent his manager back to Dennis and said, Fernando regrets what he'd said, he wants to take it back. He's sorry.
A placeholder apology, if you will. That should see him through the race, right? Lights out at the Hungarian Grand Prix. The drivers screech away from the grid. Lewis Hamilton gets a good start and leads the race from start to finish, notching up his third win of the season and withstanding the challenge of Ferrari's Kimi Raikkonen, who comes in a fraction of a second behind him. After a bad start, Alonso manages to convert his sixth place to a solid fourth. Not bad for the prodigal son mulling over his return. And as soon as he finishes the race, he heads straight to his boss's office to repeat the apology in person.
And after the race, Alonso said the same to Dennis. You know, he apologized and tried to take it back. But it was too late by then.
Too late. Because by then, Dennis had made the phone call that would turn a storm in a teacup into a hurricane force gale.
I still can't believe it happened. The extent of it, the way it was done.
It was like a bomb that exploded within the team.
I've never heard of anything like that at that level. That's crazy.
Would you do anything to win? You probably would.
Everyone's so arrogant, they thought they were untouchable.
This has turned into an all-out brawl, and it's happening in front of the entire world.
Formula One really looked into the abyss in 2007.
One of the biggest stories in the history of Formula One. But it will haunt the people involved for as long as they live.
I'm Pete Tong, from BBC Sounds and BBC Five Live. This is Sport's Strangest Crimes, Spygate. Chapter 6, Piranha Club Rules. The team principal, the closest thing F1 gets to a father figure. A good one will organise his cacophony of unruly children like the conductor of an orchestra, making sure they come together in a smooth hum on race day. But it's not easy. F1's children are notoriously hard to discipline, and they have very different personalities and needs. At the factory, there are hundreds of engineers and designers. Then in the garage, the mechanics and the pit crew. On the track, the drivers, those public figureheads of the team, and then there's those rather important sponsors, the international media, and of course, your rivals. It's multitasking in the extreme. I can relate to that. I've got six kids. A good team principal is worth their weight in gold. And Ron Dennis has got form. He's seen McLaren through some incredible years of success and managed the biggest names in the sport. So, How the hell did he get to this point in Hungary? Drivers defying orders, having public fallouts in press conferences, making threats. Something's gone badly wrong, and as the man in charge, surely he's got a part to play. Sarah?
Well, Pete, you do have to ask, what part has Ron Dennis played, or rather not played, at this point? And people do love to judge in F1, you know, the gossip makes the paddock turn around. There's some pretty strong opinions on where Ron went wrong. But most of those voices seem to agree that it really centres around how he managed his two drivers. Classic man management.
Sarah, does that mean it's all gone wrong?
I think it does, Pete, yeah. We're going to start off in Ron's defence, though. 2007 was quite unusual because the team had two drivers that were new to the team starting at the same time. Here's McLaren mechanic Mark Priestley.
It's actually uncommon, I guess, for most teams in the history of the sport, but it was really uncommon at McLaren because actually we'd been one of the teams that had always kept some consistency in our drivers.
It wasn't that long ago that McLaren had a very settled period with Mika Hakkinen and David Coulthard, who'd both had 9-year stints with the team. So this was relatively new territory for Ron. So we will go easy on him here. But now Ron is having to manage both Fernando Alonso and Lewis Hamilton's expectations. They're both new to the race team. They both want to make their mark. Now, you might remember McLaren, unlike other teams, have an equal driver policy, no preferential treatment. But as reigning world champion, Alonso was definitely expecting to be treated differently from a rookie. And Ron probably needed to step in to manage that unfolding disaster. Here's Andrew Benson.
I don't think Dennis had any idea of the sort of competitive tensions that were going to be created by those two drivers being put together. I think one of the problems is that Ron Dennis regards himself as a better reader of people and a better psychologist than he actually is. So I suspect that that self-regard, the inherent arrogance that Ron Dennis has about him, he has a great many qualities as well, obviously. He's a titan and legend of Formula One, but there was also arrogance to his personality. I think that was probably the first problem, to not realise, A, at the beginning, how potentially combustible it was. And then when he saw how competitive they were so close. But it's not just the competitive level on the track, it's the competitive intensity of the two personalities, which is part of what makes them both such extraordinary racing drivers. Dennis clearly didn't read the potential for that to go wrong. As a result of that, it was allowed to develop into a combination of combustibility that he was unable to control.
Combustible is right.
Yes, Pete, and to add fuel to the fire, some people, maybe even Alonso, thought that in spite of his own equal driver policy, Ron Dennis did have a favourite, and it was his British protégé, Lewis Hamilton. One of the folks with that point of view is technical director Mike Gascoigne.
Ron clearly ended up wanting Lewis to win and beat Fernando, and he allowed himself to make decisions based on that emotion rather than saying we just need to close out both championships here.
Right, so you have this tension building, the two sons each wanting preferential treatment from Daddy Dennis. Did the father have a favourite?
Well, Pete, of course, that's something they absolutely deny. But let's look at the reality of the situation. Ron had a really unusually close relationship with Lewis Hamilton. This isn't about signing an already proven driver like Alonso. Their ties go further back.
I'm intrigued. So what's the story?
Well, yes, story is a good word because how Lewis and Ron met is a bit of F1 folklore. Here's Lewis, 10 years old, at an awards ceremony, wearing a borrowed suit and tie, and he sees Ron Dennis. Lewis's hero is Ayrton Senna, who won 3 titles with Dennis at McLaren, so he knows who Ron is. Lewis's dad, Anthony, has made him an autograph book. So Lewis makes a beeline for Ron, asks for his autograph and phone number, and then declares, "Hi, I'm Lewis Hamilton, and I've just won the British Karting Championship. And one day, I want to be a Formula One world champion in your car." Ron did give him his autograph and his phone number and said, "Call me in 9 years." In the end, it was Ron who called Lewis and signed him up to McLaren's Young Driver Programme when he was just 13.
Wow, that's an amazing story and some serious networking from a 10-year-old. If anyone doesn't know, by the way, autograph, like, think selfie.
Exactly. So Ron and Lewis have been linked for a decade by the time that Lewis arrives in F1. McLaren and Ron have supported him through the junior racing categories. He's even appeared in the McLaren Company magazine a few times. But Ron maybe saw himself as more than just a team principal to Lewis. He's actually given an interview fairly recently where he referred to himself as Lewis's surrogate father. It's easy to see why Dennis or any other team principal could appear as a father figure. Remember, F1 is a dangerous sport, emotions run high, and sometimes you might need to put a metaphorical arm around your driver.
So Ron must have had some bias, even if he doesn't or can't admit it.
It would seem odd, wouldn't it, if you weren't cheering for the cheeky lad who came up for your autograph back in the day. You've spent all this time turning him into the most prepared F1 rookie ever. But there is a theory, and it's just a theory, that Ron might have let a bit of sentiment slip in because he was attached to the fairy tale. He did want this rags-to-riches story to come true, to crown a world champion.
So surely, given the history, Lewis being so good can't have been a surprise for Ron. Surely he was expecting this would lead to problems.
Well, yes, exactly. I think people looking in were surprised that Ron Dennis totally underestimated how fast Lewis Hamilton was going to be. Here's Mark again.
You know, I think it surprised everybody that Lewis Hamilton was as good as he was so early in that season. And it caught everybody out. So no one had ever made a provision for this happening because we never imagined it would happen. And all of a sudden, we've now got the young rookie on some days being faster than the world champion, genuinely being faster. Now, what do you do in that situation?
What do you do indeed? And then there's the precious driver egos to factor in. Here's Mike Gascoigne again.
Drivers are the most fickle, self-important, self-minded creatures on earth. So when Ron backs Lewis against Fernando, what does he think Fernando's going to go and do?
Okay. It's all very well for mechanics and engineers to throw in their two cents. But what about someone that has some real life experience of being a team principal? For that, we had to travel to a favourite F1 hangout, that rock in the Mediterranean where you can barely make out water for mega yachts. You guessed it, Monaco. And it's home to one of F1's most successful team bosses.
Hi, everybody. My name is Flavio Briatore. I am the team manager or the team principal of Renault in 2007.
Flavio's home is awash with marble and modern art. Large vats of very realistic-looking roses in four bright hues greet you in the entrance hall, or should I say atrium, rather. I've actually met Flavio a few times in Ibiza and in Sardinia. He famously started out as a team principal at Benetton in the 80s with zero F1 experience, not even liking the sport. He got into F1 while working for Benetton, organising franchises in the US. But he was such a good operator that when the clothing brand wanted to launch an F1 team, they parachuted him in. Since then, he's also won world championships with his teams, including leading Renault to victory with Alonso in 2005 and 2006. He's dated top models like Heidi Klum and Naomi Campbell, and he's a dab hand at spotting driver talent too. His finds include the legendary Michael Schumacher and one Fernando Alonso. Given his amazing track record, we had to start by asking him, what does he look for in a potential F1 driver?
Yeah, need be quick.
Need be quick. I think I could have worked that one out for myself. Thanks, Flav.
It's very long process. You need to be lucky as well. You need to be fighting for have this kind of driver because everybody looking for the same product if you want. And sometimes you succeed, sometimes not.
Fighting for the right drivers is the right term when it comes to being a team principal. Flavio says you need to impose discipline with military precision.
The team is like an army, you know. It's the discipline and everybody needs to respect the rule. You have the captain, you have the sergeant, you have the normal fighter. So what you need is be clear with the driver, not creating confusion. You know, creating confusion inside of the team between the two groups of engineering is managing the car.
In case you hadn't already guessed, McLaren-style driver equality is a massive no-no for Flavio.
You need to make sure when you have a driver like this, you need to clarify immediately. The world champion is a driver world champion, is one, need winning the world champion. And the other one driver need take the point to win in the Constructor Championship. So simple like that. The moment you put clear the situation, is already half of the road done.
So, for Flavio, it's crystal clear. There must be a number one driver, and you need to show the driver who's boss.
Because the worst is when two cars go out of the track. Because the car is not owned by the driver, it's owned by the team.
He will often remind the drivers that they do not own the cars they're driving.
I told my driver, I lend you the car, it's not your car. The car is 800 people is working in the factory to put the car for you. So the car is not yours. You don't need to have the accident for your ego trip, etc., etc.
Flavio was also surprised a team boss like Dennis, with all his battle scars from previous F1 campaigns, did not see the driver bust up coming.
But during the test, you can see Lewis was so quick. And this was completely underestimating Lewis. And after when Lewis arrived, fighting with Fernando, both was there. So you have basically, after two races, you have two number one in the team. This is... It's no good for the team, it's no good for anybody, it's no good for the driver, it's no good for nobody. There was a lot of confusion. And you're managing, you're in the big mess. This is what you're doing.
Managing a big mess. Well, if the Hungarian Grand Prix was anything to go by, I'd have to agree with you, Flavio. So how to clean up the mess? Well, for the Italian serial entrepreneur, managing an F1 team is the same as running any other business. It's not about the end product. In this case, those high-spec F1 cars. It's about the hundreds and thousands of people that have to come together to make that product.
For me, managing a food and beverage company, managing, it's the same because you're managing people. Because nobody knows what's going on in the car, okay? I don't think so. Any team manager is too complex. What you need is looking the motorsport like a business completely. You need to put together the team, you need to put together the people, you need to be leading these people, you need to be listening with these people. And after you made the decision. And it is when you made the decision, it's much more cooler and not somebody really emotional involved. Need somebody normal in the middle to make the decision. To not be overtaken by the emotional, by the race, by the noise, etc., etc.
Not someone really emotional. I think there might be a dig in there about certain team principles. Make of that what you will. Okay, enough shoulda, woulda, coulda. Hindsight is 2020. Back to the morning of the race in Hungary, and what Ron Dennis needs to deal with right now is this threat of blackmail from Fernando Alonso. And most alarmingly, the news that there are emails showing Ferrari technical information being spread around the McLaren team. The return of Spygate. Ron and his CEO, Martin Whitmarsh, have a mess to clean up.
And Dennis and Whitmarsh had a discussion. And their first thought was, we have to fire him immediately. We can't have a driver in our team threatening to blackmail us. And Ron also thought, I've got to phone Max Mosley, because if he's going to find out about these emails, I want it to be from me, not from Alonso.
Ron's in a hard spot. Max Mosley is the last person he wants to call. First, there's the personal enmity between the two men. After all, Max is the one who uncharitably called Ron not the sharpest tool in the box. Most crucially, Ron knows the FIA are poised to bring McLaren back to another extraordinary hearing if any new evidence emerges. But Ron is a man of integrity, and sometimes that means making a tough call, literally.
Dennis knew full well that Mosley hated him and would try and do him over, for want of a better way of putting it. If he had an opportunity to do it, Mosley would take it. So Dennis thought the best course of action for him would be to phone Mosley and tell him about what Alonso had said.
Honesty is the best policy, but it can hurt like hell.
He had to put his hands up and say he had no option. It must have hurt him terribly, but he had to do it.
In this series, we've mentioned some of Ron Dennis's shortcomings and the times where he might have mismanaged things. But Sarah, this incident seems to show he was really trying to do the right thing.
That's right. We've talked a lot about Ron's integrity, and this whole incident really speaks to the idea that this is not an act for Ron. This would have been incredibly hard for him, but he did it anyway. To understand him a bit better, I'd like to bring in a new voice to this story. Someone who had a uniquely intimate view of the sport in 2007.
It's not a normal environment, Formula One. You're away from your families for most of the year. It's intensely competitive. It is intense pressure. And Ron was certainly a very complex character.
Jane Nottage was the Sunday Times Formula One correspondent in 2007. She would have been covering almost every single race. You might remember she arranged that call with Nigel Stepney in the media centre in Silverstone. Jane was married to Tyler Alexander, another legendary McLaren F1 figure. He was one of the founding fathers of the team from the 1960s alongside Bruce McLaren. Yes, that's where the name comes from, Bruce McLaren, the team's beloved founder, who sadly died testing one of his own cars aged just 32. Because of her connections, Jane knew Ron Dennis on both a professional and a personal level.
When my late partner, Tyler Alexander, became ill in 2014 and we were in the hospital, by 11:30 at night, Ron was with us in A&E. And when I looked at him, he was looking at Tyler and he was obviously trying to assess the situation. He just had a look of complete compassion on his face. And that was a Ron that people didn't see. Because I think a lot of people in Formula One, I think they feel that they have to hide their, what you might call their softer sides, because they're in an environment that is harsh. It's definitely, it's emotionally harsh as an environment. And I think people didn't see, unless you were a part of the team, the number of people that he looked after, that he paid for, that he made sure were okay, his kind of family. There are a lot of people who have to give their thanks to Ron for what he did for them. And I think that doesn't always come across very well because he's not always his own best PR.
Okay, Sarah, Ron is dialing up his old adversary, Max Mosley. I'd be praying it went to voicemail. How did this dreaded call go down?
Well, he got through to Max. He actually caught him on holiday or trying to be in France.
Lovely.
So you might imagine he'd be pretty unimpressed, but perhaps surprisingly, it's actually Max that calms Ron down on this call. He tells Ron that he shouldn't do anything rash, not to sack Alonso for a start. And as for the Spygate implications, according to Ron's version of events, Max says he will look into Alonso's allegations as president of the FIA, but he assures Ron if he feels there is any real validity in what Alonso has said, he would contact Ron, and I'm going to quote here, prior to taking any action.
So the call goes about as well as you could have hoped for, given the two men involved.
Exactly. Ron's agonising decision seems to have been the right one. Later that day, as we heard right at the top of the episode, Alonso's manager comes back to Ron to relay an apology and a retraction from his client. Hey, those emails I spoke about, it was just a heat of the moment thing, don't worry about it. and after the race, Alonso even shakes Ron's hand. So Ron gets back in touch with Max to let him know this bit of good news, and you can imagine he starts to feel some of the weight beginning to lift off his shoulders.
So, leaving the Hungarian Grand Prix behind, as Ron understands it, the emails Alonso mentioned were a fabrication, made in the heat of the moment. And with Alonso's retraction and Max's cool, calm reaction, the whole Spygate matter is closed. His relationship with his superstar driver is still in crisis, but for the next 3 weeks at least, there's going to be some let-up. The F1 summer break. After racing 713 laps over 11 Grand Prix, it's time for all the teams to hang up their racing suits and take a well-deserved rest. And to the outside world, McLaren is going out on summer break on a high, leading both the drivers and constructors' championships. While the mechanics stop tinkering, the political meddling goes on at full speed. And poor Ron Dennis is wrong about a few important things. One, that wasn't an empty threat from Alonso. Those emails are in fact real. And two, before Ron made that painful phone call, Max Mosley already knew about them. Okay, pump the brakes. What is going on here? Well, it turns out in the weeks leading up to the Hungarian Grand Prix, news of those emails has been making the rounds.
What Max Mosley now claims to be the case was that Alonso had told his manager, Flavio Briatore, who also happened to be the boss of the Renault team, about these emails. And Briatore, who was close friends with Bernie Eccleston, had told Eccleston, and Eccleston, who was close friends with Mosley, had told Mosley.
Right, so where are we with this email chain? We've got Alonso to Flavio, Flavio to Bernie, and Bernie to Max, with Ron Dennis out of the loop, out in the cold. It sounds like a childish game of telephone, but it's symbolic of the power dynamics going on behind the scenes in F1 at this time. It was Ron Dennis who famously referred to the brutal politics in F1 as the Piranha Club. It's a poetic phrase to describe how, in the upper echelons of F1, you're swimming in dangerous waters, and if you don't swim fast enough, you get eaten by your rivals.
It is very cutthroat. Patrick Head, who's the technical director at Williams, he said to me, "We don't do hugs and kisses at Williams," and I think that probably kind of says everything about the so-called Piranha Club. You have to be a strong character. You have to be very professional. You have to know what you're doing. And then you get respect. It doesn't make allowances for weaknesses. It doesn't make allowances for mistakes. If you all think of the big players, Ron, Max, Bernie, Jean Todt, Flavio Briatore, they're all enormous characters, big characters in completely different ways. And they all managed to rub along because, yes, they did have respect. Because you don't get to be a team boss because you're an idiot. If you did, you'd last one season, basically. You don't get to have to operate in a sport that is in the global spotlight week after week after week and not be good at what you do and also be cunning and have all the attributes needed to keep yourself at the top.
Sarah, 2007 is a vintage year for piranhas. Let's find out more about how their relationships worked.
Well, the first link in our chain is Alonso telling Flavio Briatore about these emails. You remember Flavio, who was giving us advice in Monaco about managing a team. Well, that's not the whole Flavio story. Actually, part of his appeal in F1, in a way, is that no one really knows where this guy had come from and what his background was. It was certainly colourful, and it all added to the enigma of who was Flavio Briatore. What we do know is that in the 1980s, Briatore was convicted of multiple counts of fraud in Italy and he was actually sentenced to prison. Luckily for Flavio, he'd already hopped out of Italy and he avoided serving time until his convictions were quashed by an EU amnesty. But most importantly for our bit of the story is that he's very close to Fernando Alonso. In 2007, Alonso might not have been driving for Flavio's Renault team anymore, but he's still managed by Flavio's management company.
Wait. So he's effectively managing a driver whilst he's at a rival team?
Well, yes, Pete, it does seem a bit odd, but, you know, Flavio has a lot of fingers in pies in F1, and Flavio at this point says he's not personally involved and he denies any conflict of interest. And either way, it's a closely interconnected web of contacts. And he's an obvious choice for the Spaniard to confide in about the emails. They've always been close. They still are. And people say Flavio is the only one who understands Fernando. But we can only speculate what Briatore's motivations were. Maybe he sees it as a way of getting one over on Ron, a rival team boss, or maybe there's an element of revenge, getting back at Ron for luring his driver away in the first place. Flavio refused to speak to us about these issues, but he did have more to say about Fernando's move.
You know, it was a very strange decision. Because Fernando was still young and Benetton was a kind of the family, you know, human team. McLaren was already, was different, okay? Was a British team, very conservative, very this and that. I don't think so was the right choice for Fernando. But you know what? I know him. If you decide to do something, you do it.
Okay, so Flavio hears about these emails from Alonso and he goes away and tells Bernie Eccleston, who we've met before.
Yes, we met him briefly at that first World Motorsport Council hearing in Paris, but he's such a crucial figure in F1 at this time, he was always going to play a bigger part in our story. Bernie and Flavio make an odd couple, but they're also kind of F1 soulmates, two piranhas in a pod, if you like. They were both interested in the commercial side of the sport, making money, entertaining the fans. Just to give you an idea of how aligned they were on their business thinking, Bernie and Flavio would go on to buy Queen's Park Rangers Football Club together.
I remember that.
Yeah, they've worked on some good deals together. Bernie claims he actually told Briatore to sign a young driver named Michael Schumacher for Benetton, and we all know how that worked out. That incident was actually what prompted Ron to say the Piranha Club comment, by the way. If you're Flavio and you hear about these explosive emails, Bernie's an obvious choice to tell because Bernie's the guy who really gets things done in F1. He was F1's ringmaster for a long, long time. He was the oil that greased the sport's wheels, if you like. The link between the teams, the drivers, the FIA, the race promoters, the broadcasters. He controlled a lot of that one way or the other. And as we've said before, he made a lot of money out of F1. He definitely changed the face of the sport. You know, he was a big cheese. And as we're in Hungary, if you'd like a topical fact about Bernie Pete, he even had a road named after him in Hungary, Bernie Avenue. Now that's some power.
We know there's one other single person who's perhaps as big a fish as Bernie Eccleston, and that's his ally and longtime colleague, Max Mosley, who's the final destination in this chain.
Yes, at that time in F1, Bernie and Max were the piranhas in chief.
It was Bernie and Max show, particularly at that point. And there was a hierarchy, and you didn't step outside that hierarchy.
And, says Jane, for a long time, that duo was what F1 needed to keep the unruly small fry in their places.
If you've got a whole load of highly competitive, out for the kill almost type of, whether it's men, women or whoever, personality, you've got really strong personalities. Someone has to control them. It's like having a firm headmaster in school, isn't it, of brilliant kids. They're all brilliant. They're all clever. But that cleverness is one step always away from turning into the dark side and being either self-sabotaging or self-destructive. And if you're going to keep that balance, you needed Bernie and Max to keep that balance. And they worked absolutely glove in hand until 2007, when it just went mad.
A small group of powerful men running things behind the scenes. Forget the Piranha Club. This sounds like an old boys club.
You know, if this was a group of women, I think they would have gone on the phone or they would have gone for a glass of wine and sat down and gone, look, we've got a load of crap shooting off here. we've got to sort it out. And I think they would have sat down and sorted it out, not had all of this almost posturing. It's like a load of, isn't it, alpha males posturing in the jungle when I can't talk to you because I'm alpha and I'm more important than you and I don't know what you want from me. Honestly, I think women would have just gone, oh, we've got to sort this out. And I don't know, you know, but I think there would have been a different approach, shall we say.
We did try to get in touch with these big personalities of Formula One. Ron Dennis replied to our request with an incredibly polite email. Having drawn a, quote, metaphorical line under his career in motorsport, he has to decline many requests such as ours. Bernie Eccleston also sent a polite email. The project sounds very interesting. Thanks, Bernie. But he is, quote, involved in another issue, end quote, and so he cannot take part. Google it if you want more info. Sadly, of course, the biggest fish of them all, Bernie's close ally, Max Mosley, passed away just last year in 2021. But back to 2007. When Mosley first hears about the emails from Bernie, well, he's not happy about it.
For Mosley, the rule of law was everything. And he would have stuck to that and he would have wanted to see that being adhered to in Formula One. Mosley probably would have been quietly thinking, oh, goodness me, Ron, what on earth have you done here? You haven't dealt with this properly. So I think there would have been, not that he would ever have said this, but there would have been a quiet, oh, Ron, you're an idiot. You're an absolute idiot. I always thought you were, in some respects, not every respect, in some respect.
Oh, Ron, after the very public drama in Hungary, the dissent within his own team, his oblivious phone call to Max, is Ron Dennis looking more like fish food than a predator?
I think it was Tyler who said there are no rules in Formula One, just be sure you don't break them. And if there is a rule in Formula One, it's everyone knows their place. And Max was the president of the FIA, and I think expected to have some, I mean, obviously he had the power, but also that somebody like Ron would be grateful for where he was and would play that game and that role.
Look at it from Max's perspective. He gets a phone call from Ron saying he's been blindsided by a blackmail threat of some emails Max has known about for weeks. Then, later, Ron gets back in touch to say, don't worry, those emails were made up, where Max is pretty sure that they're not. This is getting too much now. Max Mosley is starting to gather all the ammunition he needs for a second extraordinary hearing of the World Motorsport Council. There's only one source of information that's missing. Council member Graham Stoker recalls Max's next step.
Max actually reached out in confidence to the drivers and said, look, if you share this information with us, we're talking about De La Rosa, who was the test driver, we're talking about Fernando, and also, of course, Lewis. If you share any information with us, then we give you immunity. In terms of the hearing, we'll give you immunity. But if you don't share information with us, then really you're at peril if we find that there are messages flying around.
Interesting. I thought he'd promised Ron that he'd warn him before taking any action. But hey, all's fair in love and war in the Piranha Club. Max's offer of immunity is going to hook some interesting information from the drivers. There's about to be a feeding frenzy. Next time on Spygate.
We could get thrown out. We could get banned from racing. You know, it could be the end of McLaren. Who knows?
It kind of boiled over into personal revenge in 2007. Everybody sort of lost their minds.
Like in racing, you don't win until you go under the checkered flag first. In a court, you don't win until the sentence is done.
You know, if you're at the top of the tree, sometimes you've got to face the music.
Spygate is a Chalk and Blade production for the BBC. The producers are Matt Nielsen and Rosie Stopher. Sound design is by Alex Port-Felix, and the showrunner is Sarah Stollarts.
And the wrongs and the who's and the whatnots later on in the Checker Flag podcast. We'll bring you all the reaction as well. to what has been a very entertaining Grand Prix.
Get analysis and reaction after each Grand Prix from the expert Five Live Formula One team with the Checkered Flag podcast.
What a race that was.
Listen on BBC Sounds.